From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And so if when they were driving down this street, sworn to preserve life, value life, and respect the dignity of each individual, when they turned down Wheeler Avenue, did they comply with that training? Did they follow those concepts? Because when they approached Amadou Diallo, it certainly doesn't seem that they did.
Today, the prosecution's closing argument in the murder trial for white police officers charged with killing African immigrant Amadou Diallo, and McCain wins big in Michigan and Arizona. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a brash comeback that threw the Republican presidential race into turmoil, Arizona Senator John McCain trounced Governor George W. Bush in Michigan, the biggest electoral prize thus far, and in the senator's home state of Arizona. While Bush had long overshadowed the contest with his vast endorsements and colossal treasury, his double-barreled defeats left Republicans debating who would make it to their party's convention in Philadelphia in July. The voting also set the stage for what has quickly transformed into the most contentious and perhaps belligerent Republican primary battle since Ronald Reagan came close to toppling President Gerald R. Ford in 1976. In a finding that medical experts called troubling and very surprising, researchers reported that the number of preschoolers taking stimulants, antidepressants, and other psychiatric drugs rose drastically from 1991 to 1995. In the study, researchers found that the use of stimulants, most commonly methylphenidate, the generic form of Ritalin, increased twofold to threefold for children ages 2 through 4 who were enrolled in two state Medicaid programs and in a health maintenance organization in the Northwest. Stimulants are commonly used to treat attention disorders. The Supreme Court agreed to decide whether police routinely can set up roadblocks in hopes of catching drug offenders. The case focuses on a federal appeals court ruling that said an Indianapolis operation to stem the flow of drugs in the city likely amounts to unreasonable and unlawful procedures. Among other actions, the justices rejected by a 5-4 vote an appeal that called death in Alabama's electric chair an unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment. Alabama is one of three states. The others are Georgia and Nebraska that use the electric chair as their sole means of execution. China warned it will use military force against Taiwan if the island's leaders indefinitely delay negotiations on reunification with the mainland, adding a new element of tension to East Asia's most volatile standoff. The ultimatum significantly broadens China's longstanding threat to invade the island under certain conditions. China previously had said it would take Taiwan by force if it declares independence or is occupied by a foreign power. Now an unspecified delay in reunification talks has been added to the list. Hundreds of heavily armed soldiers were shutting down an important industrial city in northern Nigeria, where street brawls over the introduction of Islamic law killed at least 20 people. All businesses in Kaduna were ordered closed. A dusk-to-dawn curfew was in force, and access to the city was denied to visitors after rival Christian and Muslim demonstrators attacked each other. Christians make up only about 40% of the population in Kaduna State, which is considering adoption of the rigid code known as Sharia. The union representing 9,500 Los Angeles police officers is calling for an independent review of the ongoing probe of corruption in the department. A spokesperson says it's the first time the L.A. Police Protection League has called for civilian oversight. At least 11 officers have been relieved of duty and 40 convictions have been overturned as a result of the probe, which has found evidence that anti-gang officers allegedly framed, beat, and shot innocent people. President Clinton will propose today that all medical errors in hospitals that result in death or serious injury be publicly reported as part of a mandatory national error prevention system, this according to White House sources in the Washington Post today. The recommendation, which is controversial among health care providers, is contained in wide-ranging administration initiative to reduce the estimated 45,000 to 98,000 hospital deaths caused each year by medical mistakes. The plan also calls for creation of a new federal office to research and promote patient safety, for new standards to reduce medical errors caused by similar-sounding prescription drug names, and for legislation that would allow hospitals and doctors to investigate their errors without fearing that the information would be later used in malpractice suits against them. And finally, Unilever, the world's leading maker of consumer goods that includes supermarket mainstays like Dove soap, Ragu spaghetti sauce, and Lipton tea, said today it will embark on a severe program of corporate cutbacks, eliminating 25,000 jobs over 5 years, closing 100 factories, and possibly jettisoning up to 75% of its products.
Community residents once again took to the streets today to protest the latest police killing. This time, the shooting death of African immigrant Amadou Diallo, who died in a hail of 41 police bullets in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building.
Shot to death on Christmas Day by New York City police. The unarmed Whitfield was shot to death.
Heaven, can't you see? Look into the streets.
The police killing of Anthony Baez, a young Latino man.
Sirens in my sleep, get the best of me.
He was playing with, accidentally struck a police car.
My brothers are dying. Is there anybody trying? Devils in a blue dress.
As in so many other cases, the evidence presented by the district attorney to a grand jury was not sufficient to warrant an indictment. The officer walked away a free man.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country as the Amadou Diallo trial goes to the jury today.
That's right. And we are going to hear the prosecution closing arguments in just a minute. But before we do, McCain won big in both Michigan and Arizona, and we're going straight to Lansing, Michigan, to Democratic State Senator Lamar Lemons. Now, why would we be going to a Democrat to talk about the Republican primary that just took place? Well, he may have had something to do with McCain's big win over the Texas Governor George W. Bush. Welcome to Democracy Now!, State Senator Lamar Lemons.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what this victory was all about, especially in light of what looks like McCain's victory being attributed not to the Republicans who voted in this open primary, but the Democrats and independents?
Well, first of all, I like to say that our organization was able to garner over 100,000 Democratic votes in this state to get out and vote for McCain, to send our governor a message. We got over 40,000 votes in the city of Detroit alone, and in a Republican primary.
And, Mr. Lemons, why did you mobilize that kind of a vote? What caused you to want to do this?
Well, there were several reasons. First of all, it sent a message to our governor that we're dissatisfied, and bring the world attention to the fact that Detroit district is the only school district in the state of Michigan where the citizens are not allowed to elect their board of education, and that the governor has imposed a board and has removed a board without cause in the city of Detroit. And a host of other issues that we have, problems, internal issues that we have in the state of Michigan with our governor. So he was building a firewall, and we set to burn that firewall down and did so.
And what are some of those other issues that you mentioned?
Well, first of all, let me say this about Bush's appearance at Bob Jones University, his refusal to call the Confederate flag what it is, a flag of racism, his refusal to speak out against the racial policies at Bob Jones University, his disproportionate execution of African Americans in Texas with the death penalty there. We can go on and on. We really didn't like George Bush, and we didn't want Bush and Engler or Engler-esque policies in the White House. And we really fear here in Michigan that if Bush is elected, that Engler will end up in Bush's cabinet or even as a VP.
But on the issues such as a Confederate flag, there's really not much difference between Bush and John McCain, and yet you felt that it was necessary to vote for McCain?
Well, we were selecting from the lesser of evils there. McCain has been actually courting Democratic votes and has been running almost with a Democratic platform on Social Security, et cetera. So we decided to select the lesser of evils, but most importantly, to send the governor and both governors, Bush and Engler, a message.
Now, the Michigan Democratic primary is going to take place, and I'm just wondering how the Democratic State Committee and the party bosses, if you will, feel about what you have done. I was reading some articles suggesting they're rather disturbed.
Yeah, they disavowed this, but this was something that we had to do with, particularly as a Detroiter, particularly because they were actually silent when the governor removed the our elected board. So...
You have embarrassed him in a very big way. I mean, you took on governor of a state. He's chair of the George W. Bush, campaign committee in Michigan.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you, is the Democratic primary, does it have the same rules of that the Republicans do? For instance, can Republicans vote in the Democratic primary?
Okay, let me first of all correct you. There was no we have a Democratic caucus, closed caucus, so that's totally separate rules. But most importantly, this was a Michigan open primary. So people were voting also for ballot proposals throughout the state. In Detroit, we have two library initiatives that both passed with numbers very similar to that, to show you that there was a direct connection with McCain, with numbers very similar to McCain. And in the city of Detroit, George Bush only got 14,000 votes, which is about what the average Republican would get in the city of Detroit. So we really got an extra 40,000 votes and to vote for McCain. And there was a Democratic candidate on the ballot in Lyndon LaRouche, and he was on the ballot as a Democrat. And so people who think that we vote blindly for the Democratic Party saw that Lyndon LaRouche got only 5,000 votes, and that was from some seniors who got their ballot before and mailed it before we told them how to vote. And they just voted blindly for the Democratic candidate. But we worked we had an operation that was statewide, where I had suburbanites calling me. Everyone who didn't like the governor worked on this effort from all over the state of Michigan.
State Senator Lamar Lemons, can you describe your state to us in terms of racial composition, division of Republicans and Democrats?
Well, in the racial composition, we're about 15% of the state, comprised mostly in Detroit, but there are other African-Americans in other parts of the state. We are one-third of the Democratic Party. In terms of the membership and voting, and very few in the Republican Party, less than 1%.
And what do you expect now in terms of the repercussions within the state in terms of Governor Engler? He's in office for how long now?
14 months.
And do you expect this is going to happen?
I've been in politics for 20 years, though. I was just elected this in 98. I don't expect any repercussions. This is, in fact, he said last night that he won't organize people to come into our closed caucus because most of this is a matter of declaration. But in a Michigan open primary, you don't have to declare. So I didn't have to declare myself a Republican to go in there and vote.
One last question, State Senator Lamar Lemons, and that is, you were talking about your concern about the death penalty.
Yes.
In Illinois, you have a conservative Republican governor, George Ryan, who has now set this moratorium on death penalties. He was also the chair of George Bush's campaign committee, but that in Illinois.
Right.
Has that had any influence on Engler?
Actually, I was hoping that it would, and we don't have the death penalty here in Michigan, and Engler, to his credit, has not supported the death penalty. He has been a firewall against the death penalty, and I would hope that Engler's death penalty policies, although many policies I find of Engler abhorrent, we are on the same page with the death penalty. But I would hope that both the governors of Illinois and Michigan would rub off on Bush, who said that no innocent person has been killed in Texas. And so for him to say that so absolutely is, I find that amazing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Detroit State Senator Lamar Lemons, yes, a Democrat, but had a significant effect, we believe, on the Michigan Republican primary that just took place yesterday. Again, the big news, McCain has trounced George Bush in the Michigan and Arizona primaries that took place yesterday. We were speaking to Lamar Lemons from his office in East Lansing, Michigan. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As Juan, we move to another top story. today, and that is the closing arguments have wrapped up in the Amadou Diallo case. Of course, the case of the 22-year-old black man who was standing unarmed in the vestibule of his apartment building in the Bronx on February 4th, 1999. He was shot by four white police officers. They shot at him 41 times, hitting him 19 times.
Yes, Amy, and we just have a news bulletin as the trial was supposed to resume with the judge giving charging the jury, but Judge Joseph Tarisi has replaced a juror who apparently spoke to someone about the trial in violation of the judge's instructions. He has replaced the unnamed juror with an alternate, and this has delayed the start of this morning's proceedings. The juror who has been replaced, we understand, is a woman. There were six women on the, or there are six women on the jury, four African-Americans and two white women. We're not sure if one of the women replaced was African-American yet.
Well, that's the latest news we have, and we'll let our listeners know around the country if we learn within the time of this show who was replaced. But Juan, very significant arguments took place yesterday, closing arguments, and of course they always are important. We played the first of the four defense attorneys, James Culleton, live on the show. He was the first to present the closing arguments of the defense. He defended Richard Murphy, who was the police officer who shot at Amadou Diallo the least. He shot at him four times. That was four. Kenneth Boss shot at him five times. And then you had the two shooters who shot each 16 times at Amadou Diallo, and they were Sean Carroll and Edward McMillan. But perhaps the biggest news yesterday was the prosecution's comeback. Many felt that, in a sense, it seemed as if the prosecutor, Eric Warner, had come out of a coma in this case.
Yes, no doubt about it. It appeared, especially toward the end of the trial, almost as if the prosecution had thrown in the towel in terms of continuing to mount its case. But amazingly, Eric Warner made a very forceful — he was the chief prosecutor in the case, and many people were amazed by the fact that as the chief prosecutor, he never actually cross-examined the four police officers on the stand, but left it to a subordinate on the prosecution team, and that he chose for some reason not to cross-examine the last witness, Jim Fife, a police expert, who said that the policemen were following basically textbook training in terms of how they their decision to stop Amadou Diallo. But Warner, in the closing arguments, really explained that, why they did that, and actually appeared to present the most forceful cogent arguments for what was devastatingly wrong in the actions of the police officers, a series of actions that they took that he kept referring to as unreasonable that led to the shooting death of Amadou Diallo.
Interestingly enough, Juan, he never used the term race. I mean, he never brought race into it explicitly in terms of a racial profiling of Amadou Diallo, a young black man who was standing at 12:40 at night, not to mention he was standing in his own vestibule. But everything he said clearly implied that.
Well, yes, he kept referring to using the word that all of the officers had used, of the dim lighting in the vestibule, after tearing apart all the arguments as to what kind of lighting there was and making it clear that there had been numerous witnesses who had said that the lighting was fine. He kept saying that the officers had a dim view of the neighborhood, and that once they turned that block, that dim view of the neighborhood was — he really got into the minds of the officers, amazingly, saying also, for instance, that the whole issue of they're all claiming a wallet that Amadou Diallo had in his hand was a gun. He basically said, and I'm paraphrasing him now, but we'll hear some excerpts where he said that they essentially created an image of Amadou Diallo in their own minds as dangerous, and then they They were in fear of the image that they had created of him. In essence, that they imagined the gun because their mindset was one that this was a crime-ridden neighborhood. This was a man who, if he was out this late at night, had to be involved in something that was illegal. He did, I thought, an excellent job of, as you said, a comeback in the final arguments.
We're going to break, and when we come back, we're going to play excerpts of this closing argument, the closing prosecution argument. Now all that is left is the judge to charge the jury, and then the jury to make their decision. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
...rules of the criminal procedure law.
The cocaine has a free value of $1 million.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. As we go now to key excerpts of the prosecution's closing arguments in the second-degree murder trial of four white New York City police officers charged with killing Amadou Diallo last February 4th, 1999. This is the lead prosecution attorney, Eric Warner.
And so if when they were driving down this street, sworn to preserve life, value life, and respect the dignity of each individual, when they turned down Wheeler Avenue, did they comply with that training? Did they follow those concepts? Because when they approached Amadou Diallo, it certainly doesn't seem that they did. Now, Amadou Diallo knew what he was. He knew he was unarmed, and he knew he lived there. And of course, he made no effort or attempt to run away because he was home. He might try to get his keys so he could get inside where it's safe, but he didn't try to run away. Now, they say to you, well, the officers didn't know he lived there. Okay, that's true. So then if he doesn't belong there, isn't it at least possible that they would factor in that a person who didn't run didn't have anything to hide and wasn't trying to evade and in fact belonged exactly where he was, that he wasn't slinking around, that he wasn't a push-in robber, that he wasn't a pattern rapist, that he was a person in his own home because he didn't try to go anywhere? And in fact, Sean Carroll said he was actually pretty amazed that the person didn't run. Well, you can be pretty amazed if you've closed your mind down to any possibility except the one that you've set out to establish. If it's a homeowner, of course he won't run. If it's a pattern rapist or a push-in robber, that's probably what you'd expect him to do. He didn't. So isn't that one of the times that they should have put the brakes on themselves and said, wait a second, let's evaluate what's going on here. They didn't do that in the car. They got out, they prejudged him, and now in the face of incontrovertible evidence in front of their faces that the man hadn't gone anywhere, their opinions didn't go anywhere either. They stayed with the same fixed opinion. And they want you to believe that this is one of those reasonable encounters that you can have any time where you go up and you say, I'm an officer, I just have to ask you some questions, forgive the inconvenience, and then to have an encounter, and it's all pleasant, and then it goes away. Well, can you really accept that's going to be the frame of mind with people, officers, who've jumped to the conclusions that Sean Carroll tells you he jumped to before his car had even gotten down the block? Mr. Diallo did not have a shot at that point because he was being looked at in a way that was dooming him right from the start. And it's powerful evidence, by the way, that these officers, aside from the Ida Vincents and the Shree Elliotts and the other people who did not hear any commands or any identification, it's powerful evidence for you what Amadou Diallo did. Because if Amadou Diallo, as the evidence shows, had no reason to avoid the police and no reason to hide from them and wasn't doing anything wrong and didn't have any drugs on him that he shouldn't have and didn't have any weapon on him that he shouldn't have and wasn't committing any violent act or any act by standing there, knowing all that about himself, if they had said police, why would he have run? Why would he have done anything? Why wouldn't he not have complied? He might have been offended. He might have not liked it. He might have found it was all right, depending on the encounter. But his turning, as they described that he did, that speaks powerfully about what he in fact confronted. He was there. He's not here, but he was there. And he could tell you through his actions at that time what was being done to him. Because if what was being done to him was reasonable, if what was being done to him was right and okay and fair and appropriate, what is there that you've ever heard about that man that wouldn't suggest he'd respond in kind? They're reasonable to me, I'm reasonable to them. They're fair to me, I'm fair to them. They're appropriate to me, I'm appropriate to them. They deal properly with me, I deal properly with them. They respect me, I respect them. If they'd had that respect that they tried to convey here, they'd had it then. They'd had it that night. If they'd reflected it that night, well, then we wouldn't be here. And Amadou Diallo can't tell you about that, but you can tell from the activities that night and what you know about this man from the evidence that there's no reason to believe he would have dealt disrespectfully or disobediently if they had approached him in the reasonable manner they want to portray. It is powerful evidence that they didn't. But then they continue. They say that Amadou Diallo looked at them, reached into his pocket, turned his back, and ran into the vestibule. This vestibule, from you can see it on the model, it's a box. It's an elevator. It's call it whatever you will. It's 5 feet by 7 feet, 5 inches. Even if you're 5'6", by what stretch of the imagination are you running through the vestibule? You know, words are powerful. And we've seen already that before they ever really cruised down the block, they'd already doomed them with peering and slinking. Well, now they've got them running. And they've got them in a space that is really hard to take very many steps because it's only 7 feet, 5 inches long. And then you smash into the door if you're really running. So what did he really do? What does the evidence suggest he really did? What the evidence suggests at this point, based on the fact that he was in his own home and was confronted by four men who, under one version of the testimony, confronted by all four men at one time with guns drawn. And by the way, Debbie Rivera confirmed, she corroborated Shree Elliott on that point in terms of the four men getting out of the car. She said when she looked out of her window, she saw four men get out of the car all at once. So Shree Elliott's corroborated on that point that four men did get out of the car at once, which is not what they've testified to. Two witnesses on that point said that four got out of the car. So here, if these four got out of the car and they're approaching Amadou Diallo with this frame of mind that you've heard through their own words and actions, they clearly had, and they approach him, and he has a concern. Get my wallet, give it to him, get in the house, do something. That's a very fair and reasonable attitude for him to have, which they should have factored in. They picked the time and place of encounter. They definitely should have factored in. And this might be a spot, you know, they mentioned James Fife and how shocked they were that we asked no questions. Well, you know, James Fife said to you that his opinions were based on what they told him along. He relied on the defendants for his information, informing his opinions concerning this case. Well, you have their testimony, and you've seen that already as to lighting and as to the commands too. Those are very significant areas, and their testimony in that respect is inconsistent with the evidence. So James Fife was relying on the words of individuals whose words are inconsistent with the evidence. What's there to ask him? You've got the evidence. You can evaluate their conduct. You can evaluate whether their actions are reasonable. He can tell you about U.S. practices and training and theory. You heard about what happened on February 4th. You heard what they did, not what they were trained to do. And in hearing what they did rather than what they were trained to do, some of that custom and practice goes out the window. Because the things that they did were unreasonable, starting with the car. And once they start out unreasonably, how can we start talking about the effect of patterns and training and practices that are reasonable when the people we're dealing with here did not act reasonably? But James Fife, that all being said, gave you some general insights that I think are appropriate for you to consider. He said, sometimes you have to back off. He said that. Sometimes you have to back off. He also said, in response to a question from Mr. Epstein, I think, about rapidly evolving circumstances. And they had a mutual agreement that rapidly evolving circumstances are to be avoided for obvious reasons. How did these defendants show their reasonableness in complying with those principles? How did they show their willingness to back off if it would help to preserve life and respect the dignity of individuals? That's their primary duty. The primary duty is to preserve human life. And they are trained to value human life and respect the dignity of each individual. So why didn't they back off? You can see we weren't dealing with a situation that escalated beyond their control. We are dealing with a situation that escalated because of their control and because of the mindset they came into it with. Why want to avoid the circumstances rapidly evolving? Why didn't they slow it down? What they did aggravated the situation. It didn't diffuse it. It didn't calm it. It didn't slow it down. It aggravated it. They were outside. This man was in the building. Sean Carroll. Before he's got him perhaps being the pattern rapist and a push-in burglar, a push-in robber. Well, it didn't take much to have him go the next step. He was afraid he'd be a hostage taker. Amadou Diallo was standing in the doorway of his own home, and he goes in the space of how much time as these individuals are cruising down the block from man standing there to slinking, peering, violent pattern rapist description matching, no doubt about it, possible push-in robber in a possible push-in lookout and a possible push-in robbery based on a hunch to a possible hostage taker who is slinking and peering. These are the perceptions that these defendants, Sean Carroll's describing, that they had as they're driving down in the car. And he calls the other officer's attention to these individuals and, imagine, shared his thoughts with them so that they would know what he knew, or at least what he thought. And then they get out. And so that's the mindset in which the officers, these defendants, are viewing Amadou Diallo. Now, they have brick On either side, they have brick. They have a car. He's in here. He is in a box, and it soon becomes clear that if he didn't belong in there, he can't get in there. Because they told you, clearly couldn't get through the door. So he's in there. Where would he go? If the four of them needed help, that's certainly understandable. They have radios. They could have called for help. If they needed to take cover, they could take cover. All those cars, the brick, it's a world of cover out there. The only one without any cover is Amadou Diallo. He's the only one without any cover. He's the only one with nowhere to go. He's the only one who doesn't know what's being done to him. The odds are all in their favor. They are four big men. They are wearing heavy protective vests. They have guns. They have a car. They have radios. They have brick. They have everything to protect him. He has nothing. And he dies. And they say it was unavoidable. It was a mistake. Well, that's not what it was. It was a terrible series of conscious decisions to approach him that fell far short of respecting his dignity and preserving his life. They want James Fife to come in here and testify about customs and practices and training. You don't need to hear theory. They told you fact. Or at least they told you what they did, and that's a fact, what they told you. They told you, and you saw that it was a lot of it was inconsistent with the evidence. And a lot of it, about which there's nothing else but their own word, reveals some frightening things about the way that they approached this man. That they were willing to write him off on such flimsy suspicions. It's very nice to say, and it's true, that police officers do have the right to inquire, but not like this. Not any way like this. This poor man was in the vestibule of his own home. Yes, I repeat that constantly, because that's a basic right. You can be there. You're home free. Your home is your castle. All of the things that we've been taught. You can be there. He was one of the people they're supposed to protect. But when they turned down that block, I don't think they saw that block the way it was. They saw a dimly lit block, and that, you don't have to be a philosopher or a poet to say maybe that's a metaphor for their attitude. They took a dim view of that block, and everything went downhill from there. Not because of anything Amadou Diallo did, but because of what they did. And it didn't happen in a split second. And if it did happen faster than it should have, it's because they didn't slow it down. They were in the car. They picked the time to stop. They wanted to stop. They could have stopped in a whole lot of different ways. They could have thought a whole lot of different things. They could have treated them a whole lot of different ways. But they elected to stop, approach, and treat him in the way that they did, and now he's dead. And they can't write this off as some unimaginable, inconceivable, how did it all happen, tragedy. It's a horrible tragedy that the man is dead. But by no means is it unexplainable in light of the way they approached him. It's all but predictable that with that kind of mindset, with men, that kind of frame of mind, armed the way they were, ready, poised to view any actions by him in the mindset that they had, that man was doomed the minute they saw him. Now, when they get out of the car, and we see that he reaches into his pocket, understandable because he would want to grab his wallet or his keys and get inside, and he turns and he goes in. Well, we discussed, that's reasonable. Get away from this threat. And what do they do? There was so much opportunity to back off at that point and slow it down. It wouldn't have been any loss of, any less of an approach to their responsibilities. It would have been in keeping with their training to preserve life and make sure the situation is controlled and people's dignity is respected.
You're listening to the prosecution closing arguments. The lead attorney from the Bronx District Attorney's Office is Eric Warner. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with his conclusions in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue with the prosecution's closing arguments in the second-degree murder trial of four New York City police officers. They are being tried for the killing of Amadou Diallo last February 4th, 1999, who died in a hail of 41 police bullets, 19 of them striking him. Again, excerpts of the closing arguments that took place yesterday afternoon. This is Eric Warner.
But they didn't do that. They claim that they yelled, show us your hands. They claim that they yelled, police don't move. They claim that they followed after him and that they took quick steps to get up into the vestibule. Well, let's take what they claim. Two men bounding up the steps. Well, that's certainly not going to calm an innocent person down. Two men who clearly filled the doorway. We're talking about Carol now. We're talking about McMillan. They bound up the steps. They fill up the doorway, and they claim that they're shouting out all of these commands. Well, now, McMillan did not want to repeat the voice in which he used. He just would say that it was elevated. Others characterize as he yelled, Sean Carroll was loud, but with a quiet street and that kind of situation that they'd escalated to that point, if they were really saying anything, is there any doubt in your mind you heard about the command voice, that they would try to command voice Mr. Diallo and be really loud, and yet nobody heard anything like that, not shriek. Right next door, not Debbie Rivera, Bernardo Javier. Nobody heard it. So it may well be that they didn't yell it at all, that they just simply bounded up the steps. But if they did yell, police, don't move. Show us your hands. What is that? Which one do you follow? Don't move or show us your hands? So now he has inconsistent commands to follow. What would he do? Assuming that's said, what is he supposed to do? Which one does he follow? Does he not move or does he show him the hands? Which obviously requires movement. So there... If they did say it, well, that clearly wasn't reasonable. But I think you can find that either Sean Carroll, in the description that he said about this rapist when he didn't even know if the person was a black male, you don't even have to accept that he actually believed that. And if you do believe it, then you can believe that it was completely unreasonable, because it certainly was. I don't know which is worse to him, that he actually believed it or that he's just said it to help justify his actions, because it clearly was a completely unreasonable belief, if he had. And you can find that claiming that he saw Amadou Diallo slinking and peering, or that they yelled commands, you can find that those were contrived to justify their actions, that they're trying to make their conduct be reasonable. By saying, well, we yelled out commands. The other people didn't hear them. And if they did yell them out, don't they sound inconsistent to you?
Eric Warner, the prosecutor, making his closing arguments yesterday afternoon in the Amadou Diallo trial. He then started talking about the wounds that Amadou Diallo suffered, the 19 bullets that actually did hit him. And in this segment of his closing argument, he addresses what the two police officers who say they came up a few seconds after did. And these were Richard Murphy, who shot four times, and Kenneth Boss, who shot five times, Eric Warner.
What do officers Boss and Murphy say? What do they say they saw? Because when you listen to what they said they saw, I suggest you're going to find that that's inconsistent with the evidence, too. And you're going to reject their testimony for that reason. They said that when these officers, McMillan and Carroll, come down, there is now an open field, and they can see Mr. Diallo. They have told you, they all told you, that the lighting was dim. They've got Barrow to come in here and testify he needed his flashlight to see around the vestibule. That was their witness, who they just commented favorably about before a little bit ago in the summation. Barrow said he needed a flashlight. These two defendants now say that when Mr. Diallo was in the back of the vestibule, they could see him. They didn't need a flashlight. The light was good enough for that, but it doesn't stop there. Defendant Boss says that he sees the defendant with his back against the wall. His knees are bent. His back is straight. His arm is out. In the dim light, he sees not only this, but he sees an object in his hand. By the dim light, he sees the object is a gun. And by the dim light, he sees the gun is black. Suddenly, the light is bright enough to see all of those things. The light was bright enough for him to detect all of this. But this is inconsistent with the evidence. Do you really believe that even if medically possible, that a person could have his hand out? Do you see any explanation in any of the evidence? You heard Mr. Wirth talk about the science of it all and the medicine of it all. Well, where in the science of it all and the medicine of it all do you find that Mr. Diallo now got himself in what sounds like a combat stance with his knees bent and his hand out and his back straight when the man is unquestionably a paraplegic? If not from A, from G. And his back is against the wall, so he can't get G after this. And once he gets into this stance, can any of you explain to me how his knees would allow him to go down on the ground when he gets there and fling his leg over, either one over the other? How did that happen? Where's the science of that story? He couldn't have crossed his legs. Forget wound A being first, last, or midway. Forget G being here, there, or elsewhere. He got wound S when he was down. However he was positioned, he got it.
And these are the last 5 minutes of the prosecution's closing arguments.
And I suggest to you that you'll find that much of it is not believable about the threat that all of them claim to have faced. Carolyn McMillan in the vestibule, and Murphy and Boss when they were on the street. And I don't know if counsel meant to minimize when he said he fired five times. Five times. Well, maybe again 16 times. Five doesn't seem so bad. But five times, four times, a 9mm bullet fired at a human being, it's a horrible thing. It's an awesome thing. And what's here is it's a terrible thing. Because there was no basis for it. None of the actions were reasonable. Not from Boss, not from Carroll, not from McMillan or Murphy. This is not easy to argue all of this to you. This is a terrible thing. But this is the fact. And I think as you look through this case, you'll see it. So now we're left with three questions. Are these defendants guilty of intentional murder? Yes, they are. Because their conscious purpose was to kill him when they fired at him. And you know how you know that? because he was had nowhere to go. He's in a little vestibule, and they are firing 41 total times into that little space. And as a general rule of law and common sense, presume to intend the natural consequences of your acts. And the natural consequences of acts, of firing, when you're aiming your pistol, as they admitted they did, at center mass, that's here. The natural consequence of that act is to kill. Now, they say they're trained to shoot to stop. But under the circumstances of this case, it turned into shooting to kill. Because they fired so many times from such a short distance, from so close, so many times, at a part of the body that was so vulnerable. And you saw the wound that was inflicted, and the other wounds as well. Well, second question, are they guilty of depraved indifference murder? Yes, they are. Because that requires a depraved indifference to human life and the creation of a grave risk of death. And then being aware of that risk and disregarding it. Well, can there be any doubt about the risk to an individual standing in a vestibule, boxed in on three sides? The fourth side is where all the bullets are coming from. Each one of the defendants firing a shot that contributes to this barrage that leaves Mr. Diallo with nowhere to go. There's nowhere he could go. At any time, if he hadn't been hit, from the time the shooting went, another bullet came to occupy a space that might have been safe. So all of these shots fired into that vestibule, that grave risk of death, it was a depraved indifference because there was virtually no way it would have taken a miracle for him to survive. And they had to be aware of that, and they obviously disregarded. And finally, the question is, are they guilty of reckless endangerment? And that count is directed at the safety of the people in the building. And I ask you to remember, when you heard the evidence, you heard that one bullet, two, went into the closet of the landlord's front apartment. You heard that a bullet went through the vestibule door and traveled and went above apartment 1R, which is where Ahmed Diallo lived with his roommates, and it lodged in the closet. And you also heard about the bullets that were found on the steps in the hallway. If anybody had come down during the course of this incident to hear what was going on down those steps, that bullet could have gone into them. Now, the defendant said this only took seconds, but we know from the amount of time where they were describing coming down the stairs, Sean Carroll articulating a thought in the vestibule. If you remember his testimony, he said, as he's shooting, what is this guy wanted for? What did he do? He tells you he formulated that thought. Well, it takes time to formulate thoughts. Too bad that's the thought he formulated, but he said he formulated a thought. Kenneth Barr said, I'm going to die. Richard Murphy said, I'm going to die. Edward McMillan says he's tumbling down steps. He's trying to get himself righted, and he's shooting. And they're scrambling, and they're backing up. This didn't take 4 seconds. There's no way it took 4 seconds or anything like that. In fact, LaVon Clark, when she described the 10 to 15 seconds, is probably much closer. And in the time when the first shot occurred or the second, somebody could have popped down to look and a bullet could have been their fate. So yes, reckless endangerment of the people in that building. Other consequences of these defendants' unreasonable acts. That's certainly a count they should be found guilty for as well. You've been extremely patient. And I hope that through discussion of the evidence, you'll see what I asked for in the beginning of this case. I said I would ask you to base your verdict on the evidence, and I do. And based on that evidence, I ask you to find these defendants guilty of their intentional, depraved, reckless, unreasonable, and unnecessary conduct that jeopardized the lives of Amadou Diallo's neighbors and destroyed Amadou Diallo's life.
Lead prosecutor, Eric Warner in his closing arguments yesterday afternoon in the Amadou Diallo murder trial. Four New York City police officers, all white, are charged with murdering Amadou Diallo, charged with second-degree murder and lesser charges. This is a trial that's taking place in Albany, New York, the state capital, 149 miles away from the place where Amadou Diallo was killed in the Bronx. That decision in itself, a very serious decision that was criticized by many to move the trial from the Bronx to Albany, from an overwhelmingly minority community to an overwhelmingly white community of the state capital. We are coming to the end of the show, but Juan, you spent time in Albany, and you saw some of the witnesses that Eric Warner was talking about, particularly as he addressed the issue of the witness that was declared hostile by the defense, and that was Shree Elliott.
Yes, it was very interesting that the defense lawyers, several of them, said that Shree Elliott was the key to the case, in that she was the only eyewitness, and that despite the fact that she was had contradictory testimony, they called her, she was hostile to them, she was eventually declared a hostile witness, they felt that the main thing that she said was that she heard one of the officers yell "gun," but Prosecutor Warner said, "We're not going to back away from Shree Elliott. We didn't call her. The defense called her. But if you accept that she is the only eyewitness, look at the other things that she said that she was never inconsistent about, the most critical one of which she said that she saw all four officers exit the car with guns drawn and open fire on Diallo and never said a word to him. So that he basically tried to box the defense in, saying, if you're going to tell the jury that they've got to accept the issue that she heard them say gun, other than the word gun, that they didn't hear him say anything else.
Which, of course, was not a warning to Amadou Diallo, but showed the state of mind of the officers.
Right, because the reality is that they claim that at least four or five times they told Diallo to show his hands, to come forward, to stand still, even though some of the orders that they barked were contradictory, that they did attempt to communicate with him while he backed out.
And the prosecutor also said that it was a quiet neighborhood and that no ear or eyewitness said they heard any warnings to Amadou Diallo.
Yes.
Well, that does it for today's program. We've been getting lots of comments from you. You can email us or call us. We'd love to hear from you. We'll play some of the comments. Email us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Or call our comment line at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. As the jury goes into the deliberations with a new juror, one of them having been removed because she spoke, apparently, with the press. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Thank you also to Robert Knight. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And it seemed to me that this political theater was semaphore, was